Welcome back. This is CKLN 88.1 FM. My name is Susie Alvarez, and I'm here in the studio to host this first show, word of mouth show, for this Friday, January. And it's 2010, our first for the year. Here in the house is also known as Illegal Radio and OCAP Radio, which we'll be taking to the mic later on during the show. We're doing a year in review. We're looking back at 2009, and we're bringing you a report as to what were the headlines for that year that has just come to a conclusion. So tonight we're going to be doing some headlines in retrospect, this come to us thanks in part to various alternative news sources out there on the internet superhighway. We begin in January of 2009 when Israeli ground troops and tanks pushed deeper into Gaza and surrounded Gaza City, effectively splitting Gaza into two sections in the wake of the invasion. The United States blocked a UN Security Council statement calling for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. Among the 2,500 or so Palestinians injured, 45% were women and children, while the rest were mostly civilian men. Here in Toronto, we were witnesses to massive protests who were demanding for justice and dignity of people in Gaza, Palestinian people all over the occupied territories. And then we move over to another event which took place in January, and that was Barack Obama's presidential inauguration. He was inaugurated as the 44th president of the United States. This event was met with great expectation and hope to be a sign for progressive change and in many left-leaning circles and grassroots movements in the United States and elsewhere in the world. Unfortunately, Barack Obama soon disappointed many in his home country as well as in other parts of the world, as his decisions both on the home front as well as in places where the U.S. has a presence proved to be in tune with the previous Republican-directed administration of George Bush. And then we also started to feel the impact of the so-called economic crisis in March, well, in the midst of one terrible economic recession, first hitting hard the U.S. and then rippling throughout the rest of the world, including Canada. Board members of Goldman Sachs and insurance giant AIG decided to grant millions of dollars in bonuses to top executives and other employees, despite receiving billions in government bailouts. This widely criticized bailout packages were made of contributions made by the average working peoples in the United States to the national purse, peoples who were not granted the same financial respite while facing one of the highest rates of unemployment and a foreclosure crisis. Poor and vulnerable people everywhere, including here in Canada, but not strangers to tough and miserable conditions, were the most affected and widely ignored throughout this whole crisis. And in April, members of the G20 met for a summit in London, England. Thousands of protesters showed their resistance on the streets during the summit, and dozens were arrested at demonstrations throughout London's financial district. And then who can forget the H1N1 swine flu? In April, the World Health Organization first rang the bell warning of a swine flu outbreak at the imminent stages of becoming a global pandemic. Cases were reported throughout the U.S., Canada, Europe, and the Global South, with a few deaths, mostly amongst children, the elderly, and people with compromised health conditions. The degree of paranoia made way for a boost in the pharmaceutical sector, as few companies came together to mass-produce a vaccine. In Canada, it was not until the fall, sometime in September, October, when the federal government implemented a chaotic plan to distribute the H1N1 vaccine, which resulted in massive lineups, inadequate delivery protocols, and thousands of dollars spent at private clinics dispensing the vaccine at ease to people afraid of the so-called deadly pandemic. The vaccine was met with suspicion and disapproval by many health advocates who pointed to insufficient and incomplete tests to help sustain the claims of GlaxoSmithKline that the vaccine was safe for everyone. And then we move on to war news, that was the key headline throughout the whole year, the escalation of the war in Afghanistan. And as the loss of civilian life in that country in the Middle East escalated to alarming rates, the U.S. and its allies in Canada and in other NATO member countries showed no sign of an immediate and imminent pullout. In May, officers in the U.S. Military denied it had allowed soldiers to try to convert Afghans to Christianity, following a report on Al Jazeera that showed pictures of soldiers with Bibles translated into Pashto and Dari. Lieutenant Colonel Gary Hensley was quoted as saying, quote, "The special forces guys, they hunt men, basically. We do the same thing as Christians. We hunt people for Jesus," unquote. And then we move on to Iraq, where throughout the year, a brutal and destructive occupation in Iraq continued to plow ahead, resulting in the loss of thousands of innocent Iraqi civilian lives and hundreds of U.S. soldiers. Early in May, New York Times reporter David Barstow exposed how dozens of retired generals working as radio and television analysts had been co-opted by the Pentagon to make its case for the war in Iraq. This is soon followed by detailed testimonies of gross and unchecked abuses of power by contractors working with the mercenary and reactionary Blackwater Inc., an American military privately owned company working on the ground in Iraq and in support of U.S.-directed rebuilding efforts. And we cannot forget to mention Sri Lanka, where in May, the Sri Lankan government claimed to have killed the leader of the Tamil Tigers and also claimed victory in the 25-year civil war conflict. Thousands of vulnerable Tamil civilians were cornered and isolated without proper relief and supplies. The United Nations said nearly 7,000 civilians were killed and over 16,000 wounded since January. Other reports claimed the figures were higher. Thousands of people from the Tamil community here in Toronto took to University Avenue for one of the largest demonstrations ever seen in recent years. Human rights organizations here in Canada and in other parts of the world demanded the safe passage and access to areas heavily populated by Tamils in Sri Lanka in order to assess the conditions faced by most survivors of this massive military armed campaign. Yet the Sri Lankan government, which is controlled by a Sinhalese minority, refused to collaborate. And earlier in the year, the UN warned that the exodus of Swat Valley residents fleeing government-Taliban clashes could turn into the worst displacement crisis since the Rwandan genocide. Around 2 million people fled their homes since the fighting broke in late April of 2009. Later in October, the Pakistani military launched a major offensive against militants in South Waziristan, the heartland of the Pakistani Taliban. Over 150,000 civilians fled the region, seeking refuge elsewhere. Then in December, at least 16 people were killed in a U.S. drone attack of the tribal area of North Waziristan. And then in June, Honduran soldiers roused democratically elected President Manuel Zelaya from his bed at gunpoint and flew him to Costa Rica. This coup d'etat is the first in Central American history in over a quarter century. The coup, led by Honduran General Romero Vasquez, was condemned by the United States, the European Union, the United Nations, the Organization of American States, and all of Honduras' immediate national neighbors, yet no one seemed to offer immediate assistance to this crisis. The Obama administration at first refused to legally classify Zelaya's ouster as a coup, which will automatically trigger a suspension of aid. And some of us know that Honduras is a very key place for the U.S. Administration. It provides areas for where they do military training, and it's a place where they can keep eye on the region. Mass protests erupt on the streets of Honduras, with reports that elements in the military loyal to Zelaya are rebelling against the coup. Generals who were behind the coup are said to have received training at the School of the Americas in Fort Benning, Georgia. After much repression and resistance, Zelaya manages to return to Honduras, where OAS-mediated talks reach an agreement for the dismantling of the coup government and the allowance of election. In November, though, Porfirio Lobo, a rich landowner and a prominent supporter of the coup, wins the national presidential election with 55% of the vote. The leaders of Brazil, Argentina, Venezuela, and other Latin American countries stated that this election was invalid because it was backed by the coup leaders and could end any hope of Zelaya returning to power and completing his term, which is due to end in January of 2010. Human rights groups reported widespread abuses by the Honduran military and police ahead of the vote. In the city of San Pedro Sula, for example, soldiers used water cannons and tear gas to break up a march by 500 unarmed protesters. And other headlines that I guess we won't be able to get through because we don't have a lot of time, were the global food crisis, as well as the Copenhagen Climate Summit, which we cover widely during the month of December. We're going to go to a track, and then we will be welcoming in the studio the folks from No One Is Illegal Radio who are here to offer us a year in review from the front lines of the struggle for dignity and justice for undocumented people, refugees, and immigrants here in Canada and sometimes even beyond. So here is a speech given by U.S. soldier Mike Prisner at the Winter Soldier Conference in 2008, but with words that still resonate today.
I tried hard to be proud of my service, but all I could feel was shame. The racism could no longer mask the reality of the occupation. These were people. These were human beings. I've since been plagued by guilt anytime I see an elderly man, like the one who couldn't walk, who we rolled onto a stretcher and told the Iraqi police to take him away. I feel guilt anytime I see a mother with her children, like the one who cried hysterically and screamed that we are worse than Saddam as we forced her from her home. I feel guilt anytime I see a young girl, like the one I grabbed by the arm and dragged into the street. We were told we were fighting terrorists. The real terrorist was me, and the real terrorism is this occupation. Racism within the military has long been an important tool to justify the destruction and occupation of another country. It has long been used to justify the killing, subjugation, and torture of another people. Racism is a vital weapon employed by this government. It is more important weapon than a rifle, a tank, a bomber, or a battleship. Is more destructive than an artillery shell or a bunker buster or a Tomahawk missile. While those weapons are created and owned by this government, they are harmless without people willing to use them. Those who send us to war do not have to pull a trigger or lob a mortar round. They do not have to fight the war, they merely have to sell the war. They need a public who is willing to send their soldiers into harm's way. They need soldiers who are willing to kill and be killed without question. They can spend millions on a single bomb, but that bomb only becomes a weapon when the ranks of the military are willing to follow orders to use it. They can send every last soldier anywhere on earth, but there will only be a war if soldiers are willing to fight. And the ruling class, the billionaires who profit from human suffering, care only about expanding their wealth, controlling the world economy. Understand that their power lies only in their ability to convince us that war, oppression, and exploitation is in our interest. They understand that their wealth is dependent on their ability to convince the working class to die to control the market of another country. And convincing us to kill and die is based on their ability to make us think that we are somehow superior. Soldiers, sailors, Marines, airmen have nothing to gain from this occupation. The vast majority of people living in the U.S. have nothing to gain from this occupation. In fact, not only do we have nothing to gain, but we suffer more because of it. We lose limbs, endure trauma, and give our lives. Our families have to watch flag-draped coffins lowered into the earth. The millions in this country without health care, jobs, or access to education must watch this government squander over $450 million a day on this occupation.